All right, and we're here with the Vancouver Tech Podcast, episode 54. My name is Drew.
And I'm Alex Moxon. Hi.
Hi, Alex. How's it going?
Pretty good, Drew. How are you?
I am. You know those Saturdays when you wake up and you're not sure if you slept enough or too much?
Mm-hmm.
I'm that. How are you?
Well, I woke up and it was just as dark as it was when I went to bed. So it's that time of year again.
Well, it's kind of weird. I think like some days it seems like it's light and some days it seems like it's dark, even though it's like the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's going on. Is it the weather? Is it what? But
it's anyway, the weather. It's November.
That's actually good because I think this is one of the best times of the year to stay inside and code. Speaking of which, how's your week been? How have your endeavors into coding gone?
Well, it's been a little bit of a slower week, but mm-hmm. I guess that's part of the process. I'll be pairing on a couple of projects next week, so that'll be fun.
Nice. Yeah. Actually, pairing's an interesting theme this week, I've noticed. So I've been spending a lot more of my time specifically on Rails, kind of the main backend API that we're building. We've chosen Rails for that, kind of just because. But so I've been spending a lot of time with that and not so much time with some of our front-end Angular stuff. And some of the other developers are spending a lot of time on some of the Angular stuff, but maybe some of them have never really done anything in Rails. So I thought, you know what, let's see if we can get a couple of tickets together, some features that have some good front-end parts to them and back-end parts,
mm-hmm.
And let's pair up and build these out so that we get familiar with the workflow from each side. And so at the very least, we make sure we have our development environment set up. And this is going to be kind of neat, I think, because like I'm running, I have a Mac, so I have Mac OS, and using Docker for some of our things, not everything.
Mm-hmm.
So running some things locally and Dockerized and some things not Dockerized and getting everything set up, but I'll be pairing with somebody on a Windows machine. And so just getting the general familiarity with troubleshooting, running, and it's amazing, I think, like these days, running Docker on Windows or on Mac and not having to run it on a Linux box, for example, or getting to run it on the Linux box. I don't know. I think it's neat. But what are your thoughts on pairing?
On pairing? I think it's a great idea because each person's going to see the problem just a little bit differently. And you learn from each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine it's probably a bit of a frustrating process if you're not quite at the same skill level or if you're somebody that really is self-motivated and likes to do things on your own. But I think at the same time, it gives you that different perspective, which is important.
Yeah, I think it really depends on personalities as well, like somebody driving and somebody kind of behind the in the passenger seat, I guess, if it works well or not. And for me, I haven't actually done a whole lot of pairing considering. I'm kind of surprised about that. I think it's great. And the pairing that I have done has been a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what happened with us, like the past few months, was kind of like, we had all these good intentions. Let's make the best remote culture in the world. And, you know, let's do all these great things. And then we got super busy and it was, you know, there's no time. Is what it feels like. And I think sometimes it's ridiculous the things, like the excuses that we come up with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have any time to automate this process because I'm busy manually performing this task again and again. Yeah. And I think, like, obviously there's a certain trade-off. If it's going to be 6,000 hours to Matt to automate it and it takes 10 minutes to perform and you do it once a day,
mm-hmm.
well, there's, you know, there's certain things to think about. But I mean, you can do the math and you can figure out whether it is or isn't. And I think most times, well, I think a lot of the time it is, and manual processes end up taking a lot more time than we even think they do.
For sure.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know what that has to do with pairing, but so you said a little bit slow this week. Does that mean you didn't do any coding?
Doesn't mean I didn't do any, but I just didn't do very much.
Mm-hmm.
So I focused more on the architecture side. I went to the DDD CQRS ES meetup, and we focused mm-hmm. more on the final session for one of the systems that we built out. So
mm-hmm.
looking at how events would be sourced, basically looking at the exceptions, so
mm-hmm.
the not happy path and what happens there and how events are handled. So that was quite interesting.
Yeah, that sounds really fun.
Typically with event storming or event sourcing, we look at the happy path when we first lay it out for our client.
Yep.
So in an event storming session, And then one of the other things you need to do is look at exceptions. So it was interesting to do that because I haven't been part of one of those sessions yet. So yeah, a lot of fun.
Nice. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I also thought, you know, this week, I thought maybe we could do things a little bit differently. I don't know if you noticed, but our meetups around town section seems to be getting, depends, it can get really long. We often go on pretty interesting tangents, I think, but I don't know how relevant it is to be saying this meetup's happening at this time over here, or this meetup's happening over there. I don't know about for you, but for me, I really like to pull up the VancouverTechPodcast.ca website and see like, oh, what's going on this week? There's a nice curated list for me, mm-hmm. but I don't care about listening to that. You know, I don't need to be, I don't know if that's entirely true. Sometimes on the other hand, I'll be walking across the Granville Street Bridge, go to Granville Island and listen to it and think like, oh yeah, this is what's happening on Wednesday. This is what's happening on whatever. And I'm kind of planning my week in my head.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought maybe we could try cutting it out this time, just have our intro, have a little bit of a talk, catch up, see what's going on this week, and then do our interview. What do you think?
Sure. I think let's try it. And we definitely welcome any feedback. So if you guys are listening and want to hear curated lists spoken, definitely let us know. Mm-hmm. But if you'd rather hear about meetups and more features and things we're really excited about going to, yeah, definitely let us know in the comments section.
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome.
So another thing I thought was kind of interesting, time's kind of changing. You know, it's always changing, for sure, to be sure. But I think if you look back over the past several decades, a lot of traditional roles in companies have changed. And there's a huge sort of, well, I don't know if I'm pretty sure there is. It feels like there's a pretty huge shift toward engineering culture and at least development and software and companies that, you know, would have been traditionally brick and mortar companies are really switching over a lot to tech, at least having tech departments, and then finding that maybe that becomes the bulk of their business. And I think that's really interesting. Do you think that there are, so a lot of times we've kind of just transferred over the roles,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have, you know, managers, we have CEO or whatever these titles were, and now we have kind of the same things. Are there new roles? Is there pioneering to be done in any industry? Is that a possibility? And the reason I'm bringing this up is because I've kind of, I guess for the most part, I have worked in larger companies, but for the most part, I've worked in startup-y companies, whether it's in tech or not, which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so roles have never been very clearly defined, or there's a lot of sort of bleeding over into one area or another. And I find myself now, you know, I spend a lot of time on community stuff and on, you know, even HR as a developer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of interesting. Is this a new role, or is it just typical startup stuff, or are there new roles to be created or defined out there? And is it even that relevant to define a role?
I think it depends. If you've got a bigger company, it definitely helps to have more process in place. And I'm somebody who's not a big fan of process. So for me to say that, it's kind of a departure.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's something to be said for clarity and understanding what you're doing on a team of 20 versus a team of five. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you need a little bit more guidance there, or structure even. So I think with that, I mean, if you look at the different C-level roles, CTO is relatively new. So if you look back 20 years ago, I mean, maybe there were a couple of companies that had that, but mm-hmm. now it's very prominent. And most startups and most tech companies will have a CTO or a CIO even.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's a newer feature.
Yeah, I guess you're right. That's a pretty good point. CTO, CIO, and you see that in government as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, you know, Vancouver's, the city's CIO. Yeah, that's actually a really good point. Do you think that there is ever a need for a hybrid, say, for example, salesperson/janitor, or, you know,
well,
developer/cook? Are these kind of too far off? Are there some that kind of overlap in reasonable ways and some roles that don't?
I think there's definitely some commonalities between roles. And then, you know, that makes sense. When I was working in project management solely, there were a lot of project management BA role, so business analysis was combined because mm-hmm. it was a smaller company and they just didn't have the bench strength, or not bench strength, but they didn't have the capacity to bring on a larger team.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, you tend to take on a dual role, and mm-hmm. that can be good until you start working on multiple projects and you've got different contexts you have to switch between, which I'm sure you understand as a developer, mm-hmm. context switching is not so much fun.
Right. It's funny, like, it's not something you always want to be doing, but at the same time, it seems like in a lot of places, at least, it's just something you do all the time.
That's true. Mm-hmm. I often wonder if it would help to have maybe a focus on two or three projects where that's where you put all of your energy and you only have to context switch occasionally, or maybe there's a day that you do that. I wonder what impact that would have on performance and just overall happiness amongst the team.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak out of experience, but from, you know, times of imagining, you know, this sort of work environment or that sort of work environment, I know some companies, like some of the more well-known Ruby shops, consulting shops, for example, like HashRocket, as far as I know, at least, like, they're relatively small. I think maybe they have a couple of offices with about 10 to 20 developers, which is also relatively big, depending. Mm-hmm. Relatively is a relative
sort of measurement. But figured really big.
They do all pairing, and I think they're doing client projects. So I think you'd have a really good chance to specialize in that sort of thing.
Yep.
Like, if you were always doing, you know, different applications using similar technologies, but solving similar problems again and again, like this site needs a shopping cart, so I'm good at adding shopping carts to sites or whatever. I think that you'd be able to have that. So there, would the context shift be, you know, we're working on a clothing site now, and now we're working on a juice site or an app, maybe, but still probably performing a lot of the similar tasks. Mm-hmm. And I thought that would be a really good way. You're always pairing, you're always doing these projects. It'd be a really good way to really master, I think, a particular framework and the idiomatic way of doing things in that framework or in that community. And I actually often think about that as well. Like, is it better to follow the standard practices in the community for that framework or that language? Or is it better to have more of a standard set of principles that you apply everywhere, and kind of who cares what the people in the community of that framework are doing? I'm going to apply a blanket polyglot approach to it. What do you think?
Very good question. I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can look at that. I think innovation is something you should always be doing. Mm-hmm. And looking at something to see ways you can make it better. I mean, the thing with software development is it's never done. It's never perfect. So you hope that you've done 80% good and 20% can be improved. But then as time passes, at least for projects, that used to be the metric. I don't know if software development might be a little bit higher. I would hope. But who knows? and what is that arbitrary 80, 20%? Like, what is good enough? I guess it really depends on the industry, and it depends a lot on, you know, customer transactions and what you're doing, really. Mm-hmm. In some cases, you need to have like a near perfect record, but in others, not necessarily.
Well, I would say an interesting thing there is 80%. I think you'd probably want to strive for a number like 100, but then you say 80 because it sounds more realistic and approachable. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you'd also probably want salespeople who are pitching that 80 as 100 and making sure that the customer expectations were 80. Thinking that would be 100, if that makes sense.
That's what it does. It's kind of, going back to project management, mm-hmm. it's always better to under-promise and over-deliver, right, than over-promise and under-deliver.
Yeah. And so setting those expectations, I guess, that's a really interesting thing. I think there's nothing worse than expecting someone to do something because maybe they said they would, and then they weren't able to deliver on that. Mm-hmm. And then you feel let down because you believe that. And then the flip side is, I don't know if there's nothing better then, but it feels really good when you wish something would happen, but you were under the impression that, it's probably not going to. And then they come through and you're like, yeah, this person's a hero.
Totally. That's awesome.
So I guess, like, bringing that approach to your day to day, you know, are you going to be able to finish this feature? No, not at all. And I'd stay up all night to finish it. And, hey, guess what? I finished.
Yep.
Might be a good way. So anyway, if we're not going to hop into meetups around town, at least we can sort of say, is there any cool meetup that you're looking forward to this week? I feel like you're going to say DDD, CQRS, ES, meetup.
Am I that predictable?
Yes.
So HackerNest is happening this Monday. I'm very excited to go to that.
Right. That's true. That's actually absolutely true. This is the last HackerNest Tech Social of the year, because there's none in January. I think we're all booked for our podcast as well. But yeah, if we're definitely looking to schedule both the podcast and Hacker Nest for next year. So if people are interested, they can reach out. I think we've got January and February already scheduled. I got to confirm. I think we might actually have a little bit more than that. I have a bunch of old emails to go through to make sure. But yeah, that's going to be pretty fun. What else?
What else? I really should go out to the GitHub. I should probably go to this week. I'm probably not going to be able to go to that, but I should go out to that soon.
Yeah.
I definitely would like to learn more about Git and zero-tick approaches.
Very cool. I just read an interesting blog post. I guess it was on CodeShip about Go in Docker. And it's just building the binary and having a very light image. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to play around a little bit with that. But as far as meetups this week, there is one that really caught my eye that I thought looked really cool. It's this iOS development meetup for beginner. Mm-hmm. Which probably should be beginners, but I think this is really cool. So here's the it's a new meetup. It's just kind of over at Waves Coffee House. And here's the title: Code Together. Let's make iPhone app in an hour. Sounds awesome.
Totally.
That awesome. Sounds exactly like what I'd like to do. I'd love to go and, you know, hang out, have some coffee on a Saturday morning. I guess I'll be here, so I won't be able to, but hang out on a Saturday morning, you know, code some stuff in iOS and talk to some other people. Looks like a lot of fun.
Totally.
And this is organized by Wataru.
Awesome.
Nice. Yeah, and I guess that's pretty much it for me. And what about you? You have anything else you'd like to add?
I mean, there's a lot of stuff happening this week. You look in our notes, we've got like 6 on average meetups every day, maybe a little bit more. So the DDD CQRS, yes, practitioners group, which, yes, I am going to talk about that. We're looking at changing our format a little bit for the new year. So I'll go out to this next one. It was really interesting to attend the last week's one because we dived a little bit more into code and the exceptions and how we handle those. So yeah, I definitely will check this out. Other than that, there's one coming up on Wednesday, the Canada Futurists. So that's something I would like to go see. Mm-hmm. That's over at SFU Harper Center campus. And the title is International Race for a Quantum Computer. And it's the SFU's President's Faculty Lecture.
Okay. And what do you think, what's interesting about that for you?
So with that, my friend Nick Babington runs that and spoke with the last futurists group. Mm-hmm. And he's got some really interesting viewpoints. He's a futurist, which is, I don't know how, probably better to have him explain that. But he looks at essentially what the future in tech and tech will look like and in general. So with this.
Sound like, honestly, that's something, it's a term that I feel really sounds kind of weird. Like, I'm a futurist. I predict the future. Or is that what it is? Let's get this Nick Badminton. We should get him on and let him explain.
Yep.
I'm sure he did a lot more justice than, what's futurist?
Absolutely. Yeah. And we do have him coming to one of the future shows in the new year.
So. Sweet. That'll be pretty fun.
Awesome.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting. I guess everyone kind of has an idea, I think, of what the future might be like. Mm-hmm. And I think if we look back at like old stories or old movies, all this prediction, there was a lot of like, you know, what will life be like in the year 2000? That was a big thing. And I think now, I think we're becoming, as we have more and more technology, we're becoming less and less imaginative about what the future will hold. It's like our guesses aren't, you know, 1,000 years in the future with just some radically new sort of everything. It's more, you know, oh, we'll probably have slimmer phones or more screens.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. My take on that is you started with like web pages that were pretty terribly designed and all about having those like, you know, fun spinny images that you look at now and you just go, oh my god. So we started with those in the mid-90s, and then we kind of moved more to apps, which is kind of web 2.0. I think it's going to be more immersive technology, so where the internet is going to be always on. So a good example of that would be something as simple as Pokemon Go. I think that's a really interesting augmented reality app.
Why?
Because one thing that's really good about it is it gets people out and moving and you interact with your environment. So it's really great for people that may not do that otherwise. So I think it's a really good app, and it's fun and interesting, and it makes something like walking a little bit more fun to do. I don't know. I personally love walking, but if you're more housebound, I think just having that, you know, you've got a goal to go out and catch like 5 Pokemon, so you do an extra 2 blocks. That's something you need to motivate you, I think that's good.
Do you think it was as interesting before it was Pokemon Go, like as Ingress?
I have no idea.
I never played that. I think personally, yeah, I think it was kind of like good timing for the type of app and that it was Pokemon. But I remember Adam, when we were at Active State, got into Ingress. I was kind of getting everyone into it. I tried it a little bit and I just didn't like it that much. I thought it was kind of lame for me. I mean, by lame, I mean boring. I thought it was really boring and it just really wasted the battery on my phone. And I don't know, like it's, and then with Pokemon, everyone was getting into it. So, oh yeah, that's kind of interesting. Maybe it's a conversation starter or something, but it seemed really, really repetitive. You know, like you get a Pokemon and then you do that again. I don't know. For me anyway, how about you? Are you still playing that?
I am. I'm actually at level 20.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So there's something like 40 or 45 levels. So I still have a long ways to go till I'm at the end, but yeah. I have just under half all the Pokemon and I got a really cool one the other day.
Nice. Good. What was the really cool one?
Oh, it's a flying dragon, it's like Aerodactyl or something like that. So apparently it's rare. But...
Very cool. All right. And that's it. And we're here with our special guest, Julia Jo. Thank you very much for being on.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be here.
Awesome. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, Julia?
Yeah, for sure. So right now I'm working at Success Marketing. It's a digital marketing agency locally in Vancouver. And I recently launched a startup. It's a nonprofit organization and it's called Digital Economy Forum. So I really kind of wanted to tackle some of the knowledge gaps in the public in terms of how technology is really impacting our society. And I think that traditional education hasn't really caught up with this system yet. So it's really just for raising public awareness.
Very cool. Yeah. So you're actually employed full time and you have a startup going. And I heard that you're also teaching at Red Academy?
Yes. So I actually went to Red Academy as a student last September. So I was part of their first cohort, being an early adopter.
Very cool.
And yeah, I'm actually leaving Success soon to pursue this startup full time.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds really nice. So you went through, what was the program?
So I did digital marketing and I did the full time 12-week program. And then after I came out, I started off as an intern at Success. And then I've been working there since then. But this project really kind of hit me pretty hard because of the recent election. And I decided that this is something I really want to focus my attention on.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell us a little bit about, first of all, digital marketing. What exactly is digital marketing? What sort of stuff do you do? Mm-hmm. What did you do at Red and what are you teaching there? And then at Success, I'm imagining you're in digital marketing.
Yes.
So what does that entail?
For sure.
And then maybe that can lead into, how did you come up with the idea for the digital marketing forum?
For sure. Digital marketing, I guess, it's really kind of just marketing and technology combined. So it's making use of new technologies, especially things like social media, search, and really, you know, optimizing a business online to kind of bring more traffic to whatever mediums they have. And there's many aspects of digital marketing. So the older stuff, I guess, would be search engine optimization. So that's been going on for a while because Google is such a strong player in the search kind of category. And then there's also social media advertising. And yeah, there's so much digital marketing. I think anything online, you can kind of relate it, like that has to associate with a business, you can relate it to digital marketing.
So what would be some tools that a digital marketer would have in their toolbox?
I think the most important tool that I use is Google Analytics, because at the end of the day, you can track basically anything, any platform you have online to your Google Analytics. And it's kind of like your home base in terms of seeing how all your channels are performing online. And then you can really kind of start working backwards and calculate like what's your return on investment for marketing and like really just put a numerical number on everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very cool. So Google Analytics for sure. And I think that's from probably around the time that Google Analytics became a thing, it's mm-hmm. been a thing, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Very nice. So I guess that there is definitely the SEO and SEM mm-hmm. sort of aspect to it. And then on the other hand, also the whole social side
for sure.
of things. And I guess, I'm not sure, I guess a lot of marketing probably comes down to face-to-face or community development. Mm-hmm. Would that still somehow fall in the realm of digital marketing?
Yeah, so digital, you really kind of do focus on everything online.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of online communities as well that sometimes I feel like are even stronger than offline communities just because you have such instant access to everything.
Yeah.
But I think offline marketing shouldn't work customer is still a very impactful kind of scenario that needs to happen. And a lot of businesses haven't really adapted to the digital world yet. So it's still like a large portion of businesses are still doing the face-to-face and traditional marketing.
Nice. Okay, so tell us a little bit about Success and your role there.
Yeah, so I started off as an intern there, and I've been there since January this year. And my role is a marketing coordinator. So essentially, I've been kind of assisting all the account managers in implementing the digital strategies of our clients. And I really like love digital marketing and like every aspect of it. So I've tried or I've worked on everything. So like from SEO to implementing a SEM campaign to creating social media campaigns to coming up with content and blog strategies. So yeah, so the whole package.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So what about now? You're looking at this digital economy forum.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that and how did that sort of come about?
Yeah, for sure. So I think I don't have to say too much about how important technology has become in society. Like everyone's starting to see the impacts of it. And then for me, I guess the big wake-up call or kind of like the moment that made me realize I really want to pursue this was after the American elections. So personally, I'm quite passionate about politics because I think at the end of the day, like policy isn't the sexiest topic, but it impacts everyone in society. And I think having a strong knowledge of what's happening in the political sphere is, you know, it's important to become like a responsible citizen. And yeah, I believe in progressive politics and like moving forward. So what happened in the States last 2 weeks was kind of like a huge shock, I think, to me and also a lot of other people.
Is that? What happened?
It's like almost, I don't want to talk about it. Yeah. But yeah, so Donald Trump won the elections. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm going to try not to be too political, but from a society's perspective, it almost seemed like a regressive step in society because we're kind of going backwards to a lot of the mindsets and ideologies of how a society should function rather than moving forward and, you know, decreasing inequality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard definitely a lot of strong reactions to Trump being elected. I don't know personally how things are going to happen or play out over the next several years.
Yeah.
I kind of tend to think that everything's going to be all right. But
hopefully.
Yeah. But I also think that one thing, like at the very least, mm-hmm. a good thing that came from all of this was, I think, the entertainment factor and just people's interest in politics.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, it seems a lot more there than it was before. I don't know if you can really call that a great thing, but I think people being interested in politics is good. But what about, so the Digital Economy Forum, what is it? What's Digital Economy Forum? So the idea came about, you mm-hmm. know, the kind of events that have been happening the past several weeks and sort of near the end of the election, but what sort of kicked that off and what is this about?
For sure. So at the moment, I actually launched this Monday, so it's only been 6 days since I launched my website, and I have one piece of content up right now, and it's called Fake News is Just the Beginning. And essentially what Digital Economy Forum is, it's a nonprofit organization that provides digital content, educating the public on the impacts of technology on society. So the way I've structured the website is to have a new campaign every month targeting a new technology, and then every week I will release content kind of around that topic. Currently, the campaign I've launched is called the Digital Literacy Project, which is really just educating people on what digital literacy even means and how it's not a buzzword. Yeah, and all the different things it entails.
So what is digital literacy?
Yeah, so I think a similar term that people have heard about is media literacy. So traditionally, I think for me personally, in elementary school and high school, we were taught media literacy of how to dissect, you know, information that we find. But the medium and platforms of information has really shifted online, and there's so much content out there. So media literacy is definitely a part of digital literacy, but I think also understanding how technology platforms work. So I will talk a little bit more about Facebook's newsfeed algorithm to further dissect this, but understanding how technologies impact what kind of information we get and then how to critically assess that information.
Cool. I think critical thinking is a really important skill to have, and especially with online news, it's all, it's pervasive. It's coming at you 24/7.
For sure.
So how do you sift through and find out what the actual truth is versus something that's been created as an advertisement?
For sure.
An article, things like that.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. And I guess relating back to what happened with the election. So after the elections, you know, after the shock, people, I think media and a lot of people were trying to find something to blame, put the blame on of like, this is what caused such, you know, a shock, like the shocking results of the election. And a lot of the news, a lot of the media outlets have targeted Facebook in terms of their newsfeed algorithm, really feeding people content, kind of reaffirming their beliefs. And in that essence, people only get to see what they already believe. And it feeds your confirmation bias, and you never really see the other side of the argument. And then, so for someone who's like, who's more of a liberal, all I'm gonna get is liberal news. So I never see the other side of the argument. And then I don't know that there's like all this other conversations happening on the other side. So kind of the tagline I've used is that technology has connected us, but at the same time, it has divided our mindsets as well.
So is that very different, or how is that different from the way that society worked before this technology, social media, Facebook, and things like that, and this confirmation bias? Was that not a thing back then?
I do think it was a thing before as well. The difference now is that information is being fed at us at a much faster pace. And, you know, traditional forms of media was TV and radio, and every, you know, different station kind of has their own voice and set of opinions. And at least then, when we were consuming that information, we were actively kind of like seeking out these different channels. Whereas now it's all these different channels feeding us the same information. So we think that everything is like everyone's on the same page, but in reality, it's not.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. If you go to different countries and look at different news stations, you realize how programmed to that particular part of society those news programs are. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get at the truth of something, you need to go to a different country and watch a local news station and see what's actually going on.
Maybe, yeah. I kind of think something I find interesting, I wonder what the solution is. Maybe you're tackling this. The solution to this confirmation bias, like for me, totally unrelated to politics, but I'd sign in to Google and I do all my searches, and done that for years. And I noticed that the ads that I get for me are news. That'll be, you know, that cool new tech thing, or you know, some programming language or a book or things that actually I'm interested in. And that's why I sign in. But this also keeps me in this bubble of, you know, did you see the news? Like, oh yeah, I saw it. Doctor released a new thing. No, the president was, oh no, I didn't see that because I was looking at programming news or like other things. And it is interesting to point out that there's all of these sources. There's so many sources for information and so much information flowing that it's not like, you know, it's not like we have five channels on television and everyone's watching the same thing. So is there a solution to it? How do you tackle it? Yeah. What are you aiming to do?
Yeah, for sure. So I think it is like a double-edged sword because, everyone's kind of drifting off into their echo chambers, or I would call it more like digital islands of just like either extreme liberalism or like alt-right and white supremacist groups. So it's almost like it's perpetuating extremism in a sense. And like, I think when it comes down to the technology behind it, like Facebook at the end of the day is a business. Their objective is to make money, and they make money by keeping users on their platform for as long as possible. And people do enjoy seeing, you know, information that supports what they believe. So like from a business perspective, I don't think Facebook is wrong to be doing what they're doing. But at the same time, I think it becomes more of a moral and ethical question of like, as, you know, as maybe a programmer or engineer working on the Facebook algorithm, like you have to understand that the impact you are making on the world in terms of, I got a really surprising look, but
I'm just thinking like the implications there. Yeah, it's a lot to think about. Is this now something that software developers have to think about? You know, we're building or crafting the universe. Are we doing such things responsibly? And that actually reminds me of, I was recently reading something in the UK, mm-hmm. their engineering something. I think you can sign up and be part of the international engineers, whether you have an actual engineering degree mm-hmm. or not, maybe if you're a computer scientist. But part of that is, you know, part of being an engineer is being responsible.
Yeah.
And so I guess that might fit into that. Yeah, I was really surprised to kind of think, mm-hmm. you know, are the algorithms that we're using to really dictate the information that people see, the moral or ethical mm-hmm. sort of responsibility that one might have there.
Yeah.
So what sort of solutions you have?
For sure. Kind of going back to what you were saying, like, I think the conclusion that I've come down to is that we really need to teach people who are working on technology in terms of the ethics behind what they're doing. So like a lot of people, like everyone knows there's a huge shortage of programmers out there. And then there's a lot of, you know, boot camps being provided, and a lot of people learn online as well in terms of like learning how to code. But in terms of understanding what they're building, that's like a whole different mentality that's not being taught. And, you know, these programmers are really kind of creating the rules and the laws of the digital universe. And if they don't understand what they're creating and the end users are using all these technologies, like we are not going to understand. Like we can't just keep on like seeing the repercussions of what has happened and then look back and like think, how can we fix this? Like, I think we need to start thinking more like ahead of time in terms of like, how will this impact the users using it? And then look at it from a bigger picture perspective. And there's this YouTube video called The Future of Programming. And I think one of the quotes that I really took away from it was that civilization depends on us and in ways that we don't yet understand and in ways that they don't yet understand. Yeah.
It seems interesting to me, like something I often think is humans, we have this thought, we're able to think, we have consciousness, we're able to talk and to rationalize. And although in some ways we seem to be working toward things, collectively, mm-hmm. the only thing that we seem to really be working toward is like the destruction of our Earth.
This has taken a negative turn. Yeah.
But it's not something we've consciously agreed upon. Mm-hmm. And these types of things, you know, consciously agreeing upon a plan and setting out to do it and, you know, maybe changing the universe in a way that's beneficial to us or to the universe. Mm-hmm. These are things we're capable of thinking of, capable of coming up with plans with. And now that we have such an incredible interconnected networks mm-hmm. Of information, these are things that maybe we can do. Should we? So like Facebook, as an example, you know, when this is a company pioneering the future of social networking, they pretty much came up with, you know, what we know today as social networking. How could they possibly know, you know, that this is the way things will go? So then on the other hand, should we, now that we have this power as humans, should we be looking at other things like rain, or it's raining, should we be controlling that, or should we be controlling other things? Or is that throwing it to a silly extreme? And then are there some areas, how do we identify these are the areas we should be focusing on, like social media, and these are the impacts they have, versus, you know, maybe we're taking this side to too far of an extreme, this side not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think an ideology kind of that stems out of technology is that technology is an extension of human abilities. And in a sense, I feel like it gives some people almost a God complex. It's kind of like, we can control all these things now. Like, what else are we capable of? And like, theoretically, like the internet was supposed to be kind of an extension of the collective human consciousness. It connects everyone in a way that the world has never been connected before. And I think it always comes down to education. So educating people in terms of how the system is working and how it's changing and evolving so that people are up to date. Because I think another issue that stems from this is the growing like gap of knowledge and the inequality that will follow that.
Yeah, you bring up a really interesting point. You mentioned the digital divide. Would you care to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, for sure. So the digital divide is kind of at the, there's many levels of it. I think if you're looking at it from a very simple level, it's between, it's the difference between people who have access to the internet and technologies versus people who don't. So that's looking at it from a very global perspective. So in developing countries, obviously there's, like, I think a lot of people already realize this, and there's a lot of movement towards kind of getting everyone online to close this gap. But even in developed countries, I think there's a certain level of inequality too, of people who are more adapted to technology versus people who have not. And at the end of the day, like, if you have access to technology and you know how to access all this information, you're so much more far advanced than the people who aren't.
So back to Digital Economy Forum.
Yes.
What you said, so coming up with new content, what are the ways that Digital Economy Forum is combating or coming up with some solutions to help this?
Yeah. So personally, having gone to university, I think there's so many amazing ideas in academia, but the way that academia distributes information is very elitist, in a sense. And I do personally believe in open source and open information. So I want to, you know, like, really share these ideas. But at the same time, another thing that's very limited for everyone is time. Like, not everyone has a time to read, you know, like a 2000 word essay to learn more about what is happening. And if we're looking at digital media, a very successful example would be BuzzFeed. They do an amazing job in terms of spreading information around. However, the quality of information is questionable. And a lot of people do kind of fall towards the instant gratification and watching things that are, you know, funny and has a shock factor, which, you know, I think there's something to learn from that, that you can use, you know, the digital media medium and share information that hopefully is more informative and educational, which is what I'm trying to do.
Nice. Yeah. So are there particular campaigns you have planned for the upcoming months that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, so this month I'm really kind of focusing on digital media. And then coming the new year, there's a lot of topics I want to cover, and I think it's an endless topic, which is awesome because I'm constantly learning as well. But I think digital currency is one topic I would like to tackle, as well as machine learning and artificial intelligence, the power of algorithms, and even clean energy. And yeah, so like, technology is a, you know, endless black hole, and there's so many topics I would like to tackle. Yeah.
And it seems like, you know, the further we go forward with it, the more topics there is.
Exactly. Yeah.
Are there any that you're particularly interested in? I mean, they all sound quite exciting, but are there any that you're really excited about or can't wait to get to?
This one was kind of like the one that really, I think, struck a chord with me, because I'm a very heavy consumer of media and information, and I think I wanted to just raise awareness on this issue. But like, I think all the topics are super interesting.
Yeah, I really like this topic as well, and I've given a great deal of thought, I think, in my life to similar sort of problems. And one, I think Alex actually mentioned earlier. Alex, do you want to explain a little bit about your bracelet?
Oh, sure. This is actually really cool. It's called One Kindness. And I was at a gala event last night. So John, the creator of this, gave me one of these. And essentially, what you do, it's a two-sided bracelet. You flip it over first, it says One Kindness.
Is there a website? Maybe we can put a link below.
Yeah, we'll definitely put a link there, for sure. And then once you've done your one act of kindness, you flip it over and there's a little heart with a check symbol. And what the goal is to promote, I think, 1 million acts of kindness. And it's just to show that you don't need to go out and do something grandiose. It's just little things you do every day, which is really an awesome idea.
Yeah.
I think it's really cool. Now, the way that my mind works is I question everything. Mm-hmm. You know, so when I think, what is kind? How can I be kind to someone? Like, even that, I lose sleep over this. You know, let's say, for example, somebody asks for money on the street.
Yeah.
Is it better to give them money?
Yeah.
To give them drugs? To say no? Like, what in, like, how, what do I say is kind? And so you might say, well, you know, whatever you do with the intention of being kind is being kind. Mm-hmm. But that might be completely ignoring all of the isms that go along with whatever your culture or your thinking or your mindset is. And you're maybe not actually being kind by enabling.
For sure.
So how do we qualify, you know, this is kindness?
Yeah, I've had similar kind of dilemmas as well. And I think my conclusion is that there are things that you can give people that is an act of kindness. So there's like, there was this one moment I could never forget because it rains a lot in Vancouver and there's a lot of homeless people, unfortunately. But one day I just saw this guy, he bought an entire pizza and then he gave it to this group of people who were sitting outside. And I think, you know, he wasn't providing them money to enable them to, you know, go down the cycle, the negative like cycle that they're in, but like he was providing something of need, which is food. It's something everyone needs. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, you do have to kind of question, you know, what is the, there's a difference between the intention and also the effect of your acts.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I think even in that case, do we ever do anything out of altruism mm-hmm. or, you know, giving this to someone, it's only, you know, $10 for me to buy a pizza, mm-hmm. but I feel so good now.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So is that a selfish act or mm-hmm. is it an act of kindness?
Yeah.
And I think coming back to like digital media mm-hmm. and what sort of things people would have a responsibility to control, maybe, and I think maybe that's kind of an interesting thing. Like it's a dangerous and I think a slippery slope if yeah. we say we want to start controlling information now.
For sure.
But then on the other hand, no matter how you slice it, we are controlling information.
Yeah. There's also, I guess, that's kind of looking at the aspect of cultural relativism. Mm-hmm. So for example, in China, everything is censored and controlled by the government. And if you grew up in kind of that environment, that's all you've known. Mm-hmm. And this idea of how like the free speech that, you know, we take as a human right in the Western sphere is not expected of people who live in China.
But so, we also kind of overlook a lot of these basic human right things that yeah. we think we have, mm-hmm. violations of them in our own countries as well.
For sure.
You know, I can't remember the exact case, but I remember a few years ago, a woman was, I believe, arrested for talking about Islam or something like that. And mm-hmm. like this kind of thing still happens in Canada. And
yeah.
I think that's crazy.
I do not know what I was saying. Yeah.
But yeah, I think it does happen in a lot of places here as well. Mm-hmm. And there's always, no matter how, I think whether we're obvious about it or not,
yeah.
or upfront about it or not, there are, you know, there are regulations in place, what sort of media is allowed to be out there. Mm-hmm. Even things like, you know, we're not allowed to view American Netflix, for example.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
But that's a decision that our government's made for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty scary. And if you look at it as well, even by like Facebook algorithms,
yeah.
it's almost like we are now participating in that process. Yeah. We are our choices.
For sure.
So I really like the idea that you're promoting more balance and mm-hmm. showing how to think more rationally and creating campaigns around that to help combat that.
Yeah, I think it's very important to, like for me, one of the ideas behind my content is I want to provide both sides of the argument. So I always kind of like to do a pro-con list or a cost-benefit analysis mm-hmm. in a sense to really provide people with the information and the perspective from both sides and then let, you know, the individual who has consumed all this information decide for their own what they think is the best opinion. And my mission statement is really to create a more informed public opinion, because the concept of democracy is that everyone has an equal voice. Mm-hmm. But if people are not equally aware or educated in terms of the information they're consuming, then, you know, democracy is kind of a failed system.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think journalism too, like true journalism, where you're looking at things from a balanced point of view, is a dying art. Mm-hmm. Almost everything has nowadays, here's this article on health and here's a product that will help solve all these issues. I mean, it really is a veiled advertisement almost. Mm-hmm. Even if you look at the more journalistic pieces and things from the media and different outlets, they tend to have a very strong voice on one side or another based on where you go.
For sure. And I think that's kind of just the business model of for-profit media companies, which I have a huge ethical issue with, which is why I decided this was a nonprofit organization.
That's kind of interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure about what makes sense, like nonprofit sometimes or for-profit. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times like nonprofit gets used for-profit because people get paid. I'm not quite sure, but in your case, you chose nonprofit and that had some significance.
Yeah, because I think when you're a for-profit business, at the end of the day, your stakeholders are the people who own the business, and their objective, you know, as grandiose and altruistic as they wish to be, they have to run their business. And in, for nonprofits, you also have to run an organization, but you're running the organization based on a purpose rather than for the purpose of making money, which I think is the huge difference, is your intention of what you're doing.
And you're kind of making that clear by saying, this is a nonprofit, here's my intention, this is the main goal of this company. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that sounds really cool. If people want to reach out to you or be involved in the Digital Economy Forum, how can they be?
Yeah, my email is julia@digitaleconomyforum.org. And you can also visit my website, which is digitaleconomyforum.org.
Awesome. We'll make sure to put some links as well in the show notes.
Thank you.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Julia Zhou, thank you very much for being on the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Yeah, very excited. This is my first podcast.
Awesome.
Yeah.
My
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Check out our website, vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Rate and subscribe on iTunes. Much appreciated.
You can follow us on Twitter, VanTechPodcast.
Feel free to leave some comments below.
You can also hit us up on the YVR Dev, the Vancouver Tech, the VanTech Slacks. I'm at James.
And I'm at Drew. Special thanks to Same Room for hooking us up with an integration that allows us to have a cross-team Slack channel, VanDevs.
Do you have a meetup that you want us to plug? Email us show@vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Music by A Shell in the Pit from the game Parkitect. See you at one of the meetups around town.